My best friend from college, Joe, and I are both huge OU fans. I've been an OU fan my whole life. He became an OU fan when he went to college. He decided he needed to pick a local school, and I convinced him that was the route to go. And so we watched a lot of football games together throughout college, and we made a rule for ourselves about OU football, and that was that we never get excited about OU before the month of November. Okay, because we saw way too many times that OU would come into a season highly ranked, they would beat up on a couple of nobodies the first few weeks in September, and we would get excited, and then inevitably they would lose a game to someone that they should have beaten, and like the season came crashing down. And so we made that rule for ourselves. And so basically the way it worked is, before the Texas game, we get excited about nothing, okay? If we get through the Texas game undefeated, we let ourselves get a little bit excited, but we don't fully get excited and buy into all of the hype until November. It's a rule that served us well. We were burned a lot of times by OU, and now we just get burned by them in the playoff games when they lose. But the mentality that kind of framed that comes from a famous quote that you've all heard before, and that is, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me." Right? The idea behind that quote is that you shouldn't allow yourself to be made a fool out of by the same person more than once, right? And to a degree, we all live different aspects of our lives that way. It's hard for us to trust people that have burned us in the past, right? Can we all admit that? Somebody breaks your trust, you're not so quick to trust them again in the future. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That's a way that we can protect ourselves from some people in life. The problem becomes when we take that same mentality and we channel that into our relationship with God. Right? Sometimes we feel disappointed by God. We feel let down by God. Maybe it's something that we prayed for and he didn't answer that prayer. Maybe it's a grandparent that got sick and we prayed and nothing happened and their health got worse and they passed away. And so maybe we're disappointed about that. Maybe we're bitter towards God and we're less hesitant to trust him now. Maybe it's something else, but whatever it is, we often think that way towards God. We let past disappointments shape our future trust of God. Well, about 2,600 years ago, there was a household that fervently prayed that God would intervene in the middle of a desperate situation. And it didn't happen. The Babylonians overtook Jerusalem anyways. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the trio of teenage guys that we're going to study tonight in Daniel 3, they were deported to Babylon, they were exiled, all these atrocities that we covered 2 weeks ago were committed against them, and they were forced into the service of an evil king. And so in Daniel chapter 3 tonight, we're going to hit a point where their faith is in crisis again, and the question is going to be, will these guys be gun-shy with their lives on the line? Will they be gun-shy to trust in Jesus? Will they be gun-shy to trust in God the next time that they're in a pinch? And so as we look at Daniel chapter 3 tonight, I want you to ask yourself, is there an area of your life that God's asking you to trust him tonight? And the simple answer to that is yes, there is. God asks us to take steps of faith every day. And so the better question is, does a no from yesterday, does a disappointment from last year make you worried to put your whole trust in him? And if that's you, that's what we're going to cover tonight in Daniel chapter 3. And so I've introduced a couple of literary devices the last couple of weeks. Week one, we talked about the narrative arc, and I had it drawn out. I don't have that up here today. Last week, we talked about the literary device of a chiasm, okay? And how in that chiasm, the middle part of the story, the middle thing is the most important thing. It's what the author's drawing your attention to. Well, Daniel chapter 3 is also laid out as a chiasm, and so it's a little more complex than last week's. There's four parts to it, but the middle part, part D, around verse 16, is the main point of this story. And so you're going to need to know that when we get there. But the first part of this story is a decree that comes down from King Nebuchadnezzar. And we see it in verse 1 through 7. It says in Daniel chapter 3, verse 1, "King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth was 6 cubits. He set it up," underline that, "on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon." Now, I know you guys know exactly how tall 60 cubits is and how wide 6 cubits is, but for on the off chance there's someone that doesn't, I'm going to fill you in. That's about 90 feet tall, okay, and about 9 feet wide. So this statue is 9 stories tall, and it's made of solid gold. This is a massive, beautiful statue. And in verse 2 it says, "Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent together the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." Underline that, set up again. And so what happens here is King Nebuchadnezzar builds this great statue, and he decrees that all of these conquered rulers from all the provinces of Babylon would come, and they would bow down before it. And so when he would go and conquer an enemy nation, he didn't have the ability to physically rule over those nations. And so what he would do is oftentimes he would leave the leader there that he had conquered as kind of a puppet ruler. And so they would be subversive to Babylon, subservient to Babylon. They would send tribute to Babylon, and they would do whatever the king said so he wouldn't come in and invade them again. And so he's sending out a message to all of these rulers that he's conquered to say, "Hey, come to Babylon. I want you to come to this statue dedication." And if you'll notice in this first 7 verses, it's going to use the phrase "set up" 9 times. Okay, I'm going to keep telling you to underline them, but he continually is talking about this statue that he has set up and how beautiful it is and that he did this and that he is all powerful. You see that there is a lot of arrogance in King Nebuchadnezzar. And so in verse 3, it says, "Then the satraps, the prefects and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of all of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." And you can underline that again. "And then they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up." And underline that one as well. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are in this group. Now Daniel is not there. And so the question is, where is Daniel? Now, if you remember from the end of chapter 2, Daniel is promoted to basically be the right-hand man to the king. He's essentially the vice president of Babylon. And then at his request, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are also promoted, but they're promoted out into the provinces. And so Daniel is not one of the people that is at this dedication because he already lives in Babylon. This is all of the people from the provinces outside of Babylon, all of the conquered rulers. That's who Nebuchadnezzar's having come. And so Daniel is going to be notably absent from this story. In verse 4, it says, "The herald proclaimed aloud, 'You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace.'" And so essentially the decree from Nebuchadnezzar is, you can bow to my statue or you can burn. All right, you can worship me, you can worship this image that I've set up, or I'm going to have you executed on account of treason. And so in verse 7 it says, "Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." And so there's an immediate response. When they hear the music, it says the people fall down and they worship, they bow before the statue that King Nebuchadnezzar set up. Now, if you've noticed in the first 7 verses there, it's kind of awkwardly written, right? Like, there's a lot of repetition. He repeats all the names of these instruments. He repeats the names of all of these people that are here, and it's kind of awkward to read. What Daniel's actually doing there is he is poking fun at their religion using repetition. He's pointing out that their religion, their act of worship is very mechanical, right? It's not based on some personal relationship with a God. It's just this mechanics that if we do the right things, if we create the right environment, if we bow, if we do the right things, then the gods will appease the gods. And so Daniel's kind of poking fun at them. In verse 8 through 12, we're going to see the next section of the chiasm, and it's going to be Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being accused. And so in verse 8, it says, "Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the harp, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews of whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods nor worship the golden image that you have set up. And so they come to the king and they say, hey, there's these three guys that you promoted, and they're not listening to what you're saying. They pay no attention to you. They refuse to bow down before you to declare loyalty to you. This is a charge of treason against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so in verse 13 through 15, it says, then Nebuchadnezzar, in a furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. And so they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods nor worship the golden image that I have set up? Now if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will then be able to deliver you out of my hands? And so he brings them in and he puts them on trial. He threatens them. He says, is it true that you're not bowing down to this statue like I commanded? And then he proposes a test. He says, I'm going to play the music again. If you bow down and worship, everything's fine. But if not, I'm going to kill you. And then he makes the most cocky, arrogant statement. He says, who is the God who will then be able to deliver you out of my hands? He's basically saying, there is no God that's more powerful than I am. There's no God that can save you if I decide to take you out. This is a very arrogant statement. And so the question is, why is he so cocky? Well, because he remembers Daniel chapter 1. He remembers when he invaded Israel and he conquered Jerusalem and God didn't do anything. And so he thinks that because he conquered God's people that he's more powerful than God. But we know better, right? We look back at Daniel chapter 1, and in Daniel 1, he says that God gave Jerusalem over to King Nebuchadnezzar. And so Daniel clues us in on the fact that God allowed this to happen, not that he was powerless to stop it. But in that moment, what are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego thinking? Can you imagine being in their situation that just a few years before, when King Nebuchadnezzar invaded, you prayed fervently that God would deliver you and it didn't happen? So are you going to trust him this time? I mean, do you think they doubted? We say, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Because the truth is, the last time when they prayed and God didn't answer, God was either unwilling to answer their prayer or he was unable to answer their prayer. And they don't really know for sure which one it is. And so in verse 16 through 18, we're going to get to the most important part of this text, the middle of our chiasm, and it's going to be their statement back to Nebuchadnezzar. And it says, they answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If our God whom we serve is able to deliver us, he will deliver us from the burning fiery furnace and out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods nor worship the golden image that you've set up. Literally, they say, if God is able to rescue us, he will. If. There's a touch of self-doubt there. Like, they don't really know what to expect. This is a tense moment for them. They know that the last time God didn't rescue them, they don't know why. Was God not powerful enough to? Because if God wasn't powerful enough to rescue them, then he's not powerful enough now, and they've just signed their death sentence. And so they're pinning their hopes on the fact that God is powerful enough, but for whatever reason, he just didn't last time, and that maybe he will this time. But they don't really know what's going to happen. And yet, even not being sure, they choose to trust in God. Growing up, hearing this story, I was always told, you know, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're heroes, right? They're heroes of the faith. They stood up to the king. They said, know, and they had this great faith in God. The truth is, they're not really heroes at all. They're just like us. Like, they don't know what's going to happen. They have a very incomplete understanding of God, and yet they choose to trust him anyways. And so in verse 19, it says, Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flames of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And those 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the fiery furnace. How long do you think they last in there? If these are the mighty men of King Nebuchadnezzar's army that take them up, and just getting close enough to throw them in, they die from the flames. And it's 3 teenage boys that are thrown into the furnace. How long could they last in there on their own? Verse 24, it says, Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astounded, and he rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire? And they answered and said to the king, True, O king. And he answered and said, But I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. So there's a 4th person that shows up in the fire. Some people will speculate that it was an angel. Some people think it's an appearance of Christ in the Old Testament. But there is an angelic being that shows up with them in the fire. Notice that he doesn't remove Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the fire. Instead, he walks in the fire with them. And it says that they're walking around, they're talking in the fire. I wonder what they talked about. I would imagine that he's probably talking to them about verse 17 and 18 when they said, If God is able, he will rescue us. I imagine they probably had a conversation where this angel, God said to them, Don't doubt, I'm always able to rescue. Do you think Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would ever struggle to trust God again after that? I mean, probably. It's kind of what we do, right? Like, it doesn't matter how God has come through in our past, we always struggle to trust him in the present. And so it doesn't matter what the victory of yesterday is, in the present crisis, we always doubt, right? Theologically, we know that God is there for us, we know that he's in control, and yet emotionally in the moment, we always kind of freak out. And so I would imagine if a year from this time, the same scenario presented itself, I can picture them stepping forward and saying, If God can rescue us, he will. I don't know what's going to happen, but I trust in him. But we always doubt. So in verse 26, it says, Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the fiery furnace, and he declared, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of these men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire was upon them. They don't even smell like smoke. Like, God doesn't just deliver them from the fire, he delivers them from the fire completely unharmed. They're untouched. And so in verse 28 it says, Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, Blessed be the gods of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. And then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. And so he's kind of a one-trick pony. So he starts off giving this decree that anybody who doesn't bow to my God is going to die. And then he ends the chapter saying anyone who speaks out against their God is going to die. It's kind of the same thing he threatened in chapter 2 that we covered last week if they couldn't interpret his dream, right? They'll be torn limb from limb. Their house will be destroyed. He's really only got one bullet in his gun. Okay, it's the only thing he knows how to do. And yet he recognizes, he says, no other God can save the way that their God saves. He's a pagan. He's not a believer. He doesn't have the correct terminology to wrap around it because he still thinks there's multiple gods, but he recognizes that even in his world that has lots of gods, there's something different. There's something set apart about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God. And so verse 30, it ends, and it says that he promoted them in the province of Babylon. And so now they're promoted into Babylon. And the chapter ends with them thriving, even while they live in exile, even while they live a life they never would have chosen for themselves. And so you say, okay, that's great. Like, what does that have to do with me? Like, I've never been asked to bow down to a statue. If I did, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't get thrown into a furnace. That's very true. But we asked at the beginning, is God asking you to trust him in an area of your life? And if so, are you struggling to do that? See, I think for a lot of us, that's very true, that we're called to step out in faith in our lives, in our everyday life, and we struggle to trust God to do that. We struggle to trust him to do that because there's been times in the past that he didn't come through for us. And we need to move away from that fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me mindset. We need to fully trust God. Like, God is fully capable of rescue in your life. He's fully capable of sustaining you regardless of what you think. And we need to step out in faith and trust him. I think a second practical application point from the text is, are you bowing down to idols? See, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were asked to bow down to this idol and to worship it. And had they done so, they would have never gone through any of this. But the end result of it was that King Nebuchadnezzar recognizes something about their God. They're promoted, they thrive because they stood up for their faith, because they refused to bow down to idols. You see, if you're putting things that are meant, or if you're putting things that are meant to be secondary things in the place of God, you're never going to be effective in your walk as a believer. If you really want to have impact for the kingdom, if you want to lead people to Christ, if you want people to notice something different about you, the way that you live your life, you're only going to do that if God is in his proper place. If God's number 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 on your list, it's going to be very difficult for him to use you. It's going to be very difficult for him to work in your life. And so if that's you, if you're struggling to put things in their proper place, if you're struggling to fully pursue God, maybe tonight you need to ask God to help you to identify those idols in your life. Maybe you need to get some help. Maybe you need an accountability partner. Maybe you need to talk to a small group leader. You need to ask God to help you to begin to truly worship him, to put him first. And then one other thing that I want to point out is that there is an inherent danger in this text. And this is something that I heard growing up in church. It's something I'm sure that you've heard before. And it's saying that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they thrived because they took a stand for their faith. And so we come away with this mindset that I'm going to trust God in every aspect of my life. And if I do that, if I put him first, if I have enough faith, if I trust him enough, then he's going to say yes to me and everything's going to work out. Maybe, but maybe not. Like, God might say no again. There's no formula to getting God to work things out for you in a way that you want. It doesn't work that way. And so if you step out in faith, and it fails, if you step out in faith and things don't go right, it's not because you didn't have enough faith in God. It's simply because maybe it wasn't God's plan. But what you need to know is in those difficult times when God says no, that he'll meet you in the fire. Now, he lives inside of you. The Spirit lives in us as believers, and he will sustain you. He may not pull you out of the fire, but he'll walk through it with you, and he'll teach you things along the way. We've said a couple times through this series that God is always working behind the scenes for his glory and for your ultimate good. The truth is, what you're asking for, what you're praying for, what you're stepping out in faith for, it might not be for your good. It might not be for His glory. He has a plan, and His plan is bigger than yours. All we can do is step out in faith. In 2015, there was a shocking story that came out on the news. Some of you guys may remember it. It was a story about 21 Christians who were abducted by ISIS in Libya, and they were beheaded because of their faith. They were tradesmen, construction workers, and ISIS lined them up, and they went down the line, and they asked one at a time, "Will you renounce Christ?" And one by one, these men said, "No, I cannot renounce Christ," and they would behead them. And they would go to the next person and ask, "Will you renounce Christ?" They would say no, and they killed him. And they took a video of all of it, and they posted it online. And it was one of the first of those type of videos that came out, and so it shocked the world. But that wasn't the only thing that was shocking about the video. There were 21 people that were killed, and the 21st person, reports came out that that person was not a believer. They were not a Christian, but they worked around these men who were, and he's not a believer, and yet as he sat there and he watched these men die for their faith, when they got to him, they said, "Will you renounce Christ?" And he said, "Their God is my God." And they were the last words that he ever spoke. He wasn't a believer when it started, right? Every one of those guys would have prayed and said, "God, would you deliver me from this? Would you save my life?" In fact, I'm sure that they did. Throughout the entire process, I'm sure that they hoped that God would intervene and save them. And yet God had bigger plans. God was working for His glory behind the scenes because one of their coworkers, one of the men that they worked with, became a believer through their witness. And as that video went out and believers around the world saw that, people in the Middle East saw that, people began to put their faith in Christ because of the witness of those guys. And you say, okay, that was for God's glory, but I'm not sure how it worked out good for them. It worked out great for them because the next moment they were in the presence of Christ, experiencing Him in all of His glory. In 1 Peter chapter 4, Peter writes to a group of people that's being persecuted. And in verse 12, he says, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when His glory is revealed. If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you." Peter was writing to encourage believers who were being persecuted, believers who were going through a difficult time because of their faith, and he said, "Rejoice, because in your sufferings, you're knowing Christ more." You see, our end goal in life, the chief end of man, is to know Christ deeply and to make Him known. And in suffering, we know Christ more because He suffered and died for us. And so my prayer for you guys is that as you go through life, that you would not let disappointments of yesterday or last year or last month or whatever it is, that you wouldn't let those hold down your faith in Christ, but that you would put your faith in Him daily, that you would trust Him to sustain you in the difficult times of life, and that you would walk with Him daily. Let me pray for you, and we'll head to small groups. Father, I thank you for this group of students, and I thank you for the opportunity to share your word, to study it together. Father, I pray that you would be with this small group time. I ask that you would be with our leaders. Give them wisdom as they guide this discussion. Father, I pray that this wouldn't just be a time that we talk about school and what's going on at home and all those things, but I pray that we would really dig deep into your word together, God. I pray that we would begin to open up and share about what's truly going on in our lives. Not the surface level things that are easy to talk about, but the faith level things that are sometimes difficult, God. I pray that we would be an encouragement to one another. I pray that we would hold one another accountable. I ask that we would begin to grow in our walks. I pray that we would begin to step out in faith daily and live the lives that you've called us to. Amen.